94.3 WYBC, the rhythm of the city. I'm Juan Castillo, and this is the Electric Drum. Now, this morning, it is my pleasure to have in the studio with me Crystal Emery. She's got a book and a film and, you know, just perfect for Black history. It's Against All Odds, celebrating Black women in medicine. We're going to be talking a lot about that during this hour, but we're also going to talk about her life. How you doing today?
Hey, Juan, I'm doing good.
Wonderful. So tell us about your childhood. Where did you grow up?
I grew up here in New Haven. I grew up out Brookside. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm an out-the-way girl. And I grew up out there in the day when it was like living in condominiums on a nature preserve.
Wow. So what was it like? Tell us about growing up in New Haven around that period of time. Tell us about what was the climate like?
You know, it's interesting because I'm a 60s baby.
Yes.
So I was born in 1961. And growing up out Brookside really amplified it takes a village to raise a child. And so it's a one-way street, or at that time it was a one-way street. So you knew everybody on the block. And it was a wonderful era because you had the civil rights movement happening. You had the Black Panther Party. Like, for me, the Black Panther Party was such an influence. They had an office over there at the beginning of Dixwell Avenue, and we'd go over there with our babysitters and read and, you know, do their after-school program. And so it was a very fertile ground. People were coming into their own understanding of being, you know, say it loud, I'm Black and I'm proud.
Yes.
And so it was a wonderful time to grow up, you know, new opportunities. But again, the Brookside community was very insulated. And so, you know, there was a wonderful feeling of security, safety. Because if someone was driving down the street, you know, if it was a different car, everybody took notice. So it was, I am a product of it takes a village to raise a child.
So tell me educationally, what schools did you go to and who were some of your influences?
Well, you know, the hard part for me was I started at Catherine Brennan in kindergarten, and I was one of the first kids bused in Connecticut. And by second grade, I was bused with a select group of kids in New Haven to Cheshire. And I am not a advocate for busing.
Wow.
Because every day, it was like a open war on us. Go ahead.
No, that's interesting. I mean, you got bused to Cheshire. Cheshire still continues to be a predominantly white community, right?
Mm-hmm.
So educationally, they did that because they thought that you'd be able to get a better education. Did you?
You know, it's interesting. At the time, Catherine Brennan was a really good school. I mean, we had great teachers, whether it was people like Winnie Dixon or Mrs. York. You know, teaching has changed now. But then we had really great teachers. Am I going to say that I got a better education? In many ways, yes. The classrooms in Cheshire were smaller. There were much more resources available to support that class. And the language was, and again, you know, kids have to learn, you know, a certain vocabulary or language skills by a certain age. So those things were better. But we had to get up earlier than our fellow friends in our neighborhood.
Yes.
Take this bus, and I remember the bus would stop in Brookside It stopped on the corner of Winchester and Bassett. And what I find interesting is that the kids that were part of this program called Project Concern, most of us went to college. But when we got to Cheshire, it was literally like open season. And one of the schools, the first school out there that we went to, we were not allowed to go to recess. So I'm in second grade, and we're not going to recess. Every day, the lunch monitor found a reason why we couldn't go to recess. So as, you know, little black kids, you know you're being punished. You're not going to go home and say, you know what, I did something bad, I can't go to recess. But after 2 months, I said to my grandmother, I said, Nana, every day I try to be really good, and every day we can't go to recess. And there were about 7 of us. And she said, well, why? I said, every day, you know, Mrs. whoever her name was, says that we're bad and we can't play with the other children. And my grandmother was like, we'll deal with that. The next thing I know, she's calling. The monitor at that time was P.J. Anderson and Mrs. Gibson, I think. And the next thing I know, there's a big deal being going on. Now, you're in second grade. You really don't know what racism is.
Right.
Well, the monitor had decided that she did not like the integration of Cheshire schools and that we would not be allowed to play with the white kids. Eventually, that woman was relieved of her duty. I think there were several legal things that happened. By the time we got to fifth grade, they had built a new school, Highland School. And I remember going in, and one of the white kids brought a knife, and he said, my father said niggers don't have red blood. And I still have the scar on my wrist where he cut my arm to see if I had red blood. Now, unfortunately, he had to get a beat down for that. and he got a serious beat down, and I got suspended. So every day we were bombarded with dealing with racism as children and not even understanding what it was. Now, for me, that worked out in my development because in fifth grade, in response to all these incidents, I wrote and directed my first play there.
Wow.
And I was already writing and directing plays with my brothers and cousins and friends in Brookside. I would do these Green Hornet and Cato versus Batman and Robin. Because I had all brothers at the time.
Right.
And then afterward, we would end each episode in our front yard with the Coca-Cola song, I'd Like to Teach the World to Sing. And so, you know, in response to this very difficult situation in going to school at Highland, I wrote and directed my first big play.
It's very ironic. Juan Castillo, which I was speaking with Crystal Emery, she's written a book, Against All Odds, Celebrating Black Women in Medicine. She's also has a film that she's directed and brought forth, and we're going to be talking more about that. Right now, we're talking about her life here in New Haven, how she, you know, grew up in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and, you know, we just finished talking about her getting bused to Cheshire and experiencing some of the racial issues and problems of that era, which are still happening today in some form or fashion. So we're talking about, you know, her history here in the city. And so, for how long did you stay into the school system in Cheshire? Did you go through high school there?
No, because okay. I'm going to tell you. First off, and I told you that, you know, the Black Panthers and the Muslim movement had a profound effect And so I remember I got kicked out of Girl Scouts in Cheshire because I wouldn't salute the flag. Mm. And they were like, that's anti-American. That's not what the Girl Scouts stand for. Well, the real deal is I didn't like the Girl Scouts anyway because they took us on a camping trip, and we were supposed to sleep outside with some bugs. And, you know, I was definitely not an outdoor girl. And then I started bringing the Muhammad Speaks paper to school in fifth grade. And they actually recommended that I go to Clifford Beers because they said I was openly hostile, which is interesting because I was. I was openly hostile to an environment that was openly hostile to me. I did, after fifth grade, I did not desire to, nor did they desire to have me back.
You mentioned that you didn't want to, sing the national anthem or whatever you had mentioned earlier. How does that affect it, you know, today? You know, I mean, do you still feel that way? Has the country changed?
No, I'm American.
Yes.
You know, I think that the 60s and not saluting the flag or not singing the national anthem had its purpose because that national anthem was not living the truth in our community. You know, we were not protected. We were not considered full participants in American experience. And so by not singing it or saluting that flag, a statement was being made. You know, we are not going to condone and salute the hypocrisy of how we're being treated as black people in America.
So you ended up leaving, and what school did you go to after that?
I went to Catherine Brennan for 1 year.
Yes.
And then I went to Sheridan.
Okay. And high school?
I went to Hill House, sort of.
Right.
I wasn't here for ninth grade. I went to live with my grandmother, who I missed so dearly when she moved. When I came back to Hill House, I ended up getting into one of the first college-bound programs. I think it was called the Macy program. So I took two classes at Yale, and I took two classes at high school. And so I sort of was living in between, you know, both worlds.
Who were some of your mentors during that period of time? Obviously, you know, you went through a lot of trauma over in Cheshire. And, I mean, being moved from schools to schools to schools, that's not a very good thing for a young person. Very traumatic.
No, it wasn't traumatic for me.
No, it wasn't. Oh, okay, that's interesting. Tell me why.
You know what, Juan? I think that we all are individuals.
Yes.
And that children have the experiences that they need to create who they are.
Mm.
And so my father was married 3 times. I have 12 brothers and sisters. I'm the oldest of 12. I'm very flexible.
Mm.
And sometimes coming out of your community are having a varied of experiences help you.
Yes.
Think about the kids that never come out of their 6 blocks.
That's right.
You know, they lack a lot of social skills.
Mm.
They don't know how to interact with the predominantly white community. And so it wasn't that, you know, I was moved around a lot. You know, I still lived in Brookside. I still had my same support base. Mm. But when I think about who are my mentors and heroes, I always think about my grandmother.
Wow, okay.
You know,
Tell me about her.
Well, growing up in my house, I never heard, oh, those black people or oh, those white people. You know, race was never an issue. And living in Brookside, I mean, our neighbors are white. You know, one neighbor was Puerto Rican, Jewish, Catholic. And so I grew up in an environment where every day race was not an issue. I never heard my grandmother lie. I never heard her lie to a bill collector. I never heard her talk negatively about other people. And she always looked, for the good in a situation.
Yes.
And that foundation allowed me to whatever was going on, to look for good. And my grandmother lived the teachings of the Bible. You know, she was a minister, but she didn't preach to you. She lived by example. And I learned early that it's not about the words, it's about the action.
Mm.
And so she was my greatest mentor. And then in the school system, you know, there were people like Wyatt Jackson, who ran the after-school program out of Catherine Brennan. Those guys would do whatever it took to help you if you demonstrated that you wanted to go a different positive path. And, you know, they were always there. So in my early years, you know, my mother, you know, went back to high school, college. We're four bad kids to become a nurse. So the people around me were my mentors. Later, it would be the folks at 211 Park Street.
Mm.
Khalid Lum was a great influencer in my life.
Afro-AM Center.
Afro-American Cultural Center at Yale. I learned so much with him. Dwight Andrews, Muhammad Abdul. Those were Caroline Jackson, were, you know, my mentors. And then as I went to college, Lloyd Richards, the great director.
Yes, yes.
Of our time, took me under his wing.
Wow.
And I toured around the country with him.
Mm.
So, you know, I had great role models.
This is Juan Castillo. I'm speaking with Crystal Emery. She's written a book, Against All Odds, Celebrating Black Women in Medicine, Changing the Face of Medicine, pretty much. We're going to be talking about that extensively because, you know, we're going to be talking here for an hour. I want to give that book, like, and that effort, like, about a half an hour, right? Because we're going to need that time. But let's quickly move into college. Where did you go to school and what happened?
You know, I went to UConn.
Yes.
And by the time I got to UConn, you know, I had lived separately from my parents. For a while, I had lived with an aunt who was a great experience. Because, you know, Juan, you know, you're a parent. Every child is different.
Yes.
And, you know, growing up out Brookside, there was nobody that did theater or, you know, said, I want to make movies. But I have to say that my community supported me.
Mm.
You know, whenever I would do a play at Yale or at school, they would come out. So I get to UConn, and it is like reliving Cheshire.
Wow.
And it was challenging because I was in a department where there were only five other blacks, and by the time I graduated, there were only three. There was only one black professor, Dr. Leon Bailey, and it was so limiting. So here I am, this bright and shiny star, and I go to audition my freshman year for a play. And the play is The Crucible. So I get a call back. Now everybody is hooting and hollering because it's very rare for a freshman to get a call back for a play on main stage. So I go and do the second audition, and I get casted as T. Kituba the slave. Now, dude, I did not work hard like that, nor my people, for me to go to college.
Wow.
And the first role I play is as a slave. That was not going to happen.
That's deep.
And so I go to talk to the director, and I say, there are numerous parts in this play that I could do. I'm lectured that I'm giving the opportunity to be on main stage. I'm told by the guy that recruited me, don't blow this. Nobody has ever turned down a part. You will never get another opportunity. And I turned down the part. And I never got another opportunity.
Hence, we just had no black actors or actresses nominated at the
Oscars.
Yes.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay, so I got the question. When did you first realize as a young person, like, did you like the movies? Did you watch television? Where did you get this thirst?
You know what? It's funny. It wasn't a thirst. I was born that way.
Okay. Wow.
You know, you're born, Juan, you were born who you are, you know, and you can either cultivate that or not.
Yes.
I was born a storyteller, right? I've done this since I was a kid, 4 years old, telling stories. The other thing is I'm an Emory, and Emorys are the biggest storytellers, and I don't mean that in the griot sense. So it comes naturally in my DNA to tell a big old lie. The difference is I've taken the art of storytelling and turned it into something positive and useful. When I was 7 and 8 and 9, my family would go to New York to visit my mother's family that had migrated up from the South. And there was a movie theater. And I went to see For the Love of Ivy with Sidney Poitier.
Yes, yes.
And I was 7 years old.
Wow.
And I just fell in love with him because he looked like my daddy. He was dark, well-dressed. And my father, Robert F. Emory, was dark and well-dressed. He was an entrepreneur. My mother looked like Abby Lincoln a little.
Wow.
And she was going back to school during that time. And so here's the opportunity that I'm seeing people that look like me with the same experiences. Did I consciously know that? No. When Sidney Poitier came out with Buck and the Preacher, oh, my God. I was the kid, and I have 8 brothers, that could not watch a Western. And I couldn't watch a Western because I got tired of the Indians getting slaughtered by white people.
Exactly.
Now we have Buck and the Preacher with Sidney Poitier, Harry Belafonte, and Ruby Dee, and they're the good guys.
Yeah.
Right? So this groundwork was laid in my psyche. It would not be until 2011, I was working on my master's degree at the New School in New York, and my dissertation was on the work of Sidney Poitier.
Wow.
As a vehicle of social change.
Mm.
It would not be until then that I consciously recognized the influence that his work had on who I am.
This is Juan Castillo. I'm speaking with Crystal Emory. She's got a book, Against All Odds, Celebrating Black Women in Medicine. And she also has a film dealing with the same issue. We got to get into this because this here, being Black History Month, and of course at YBC, we celebrate Black History every day, 365, 24/7. So this is not a special month, so to speak. This is who we are all year. And it just happened that I'm going to have Crystal on during this month. But in any case, so a lot of folks that deal with, you know, with our health system, don't see a lot of people of color who are doctors, you know, and especially black women who are doctors. To be able to trust someone, to be able to deal with someone's health issues, it helps when you have someone that looks like you.
Well, all studies have shown that a person lowers their defense mechanisms and are more apt to be compliant to the doctor's instructions when the doctor looks like them. And that's across the board. It's not just black people or Hispanic people. It's white people. White males like white male doctors, you know. And so, you know, the thing about Connecticut and New Haven, it's a small state, and it houses big inequities. But the interesting thing is that because it's so small, we can make a impact. You know, Connecticut Health Foundation is an example of one of these organizations that has been here and trying to open up the workforce and get more blacks into the medical profession.
Which goes back to education. Really pushing our young people to be more involved with the sciences and math and you know, the types of subjects that you need to be able to have to go into a pre-med type of program and so forth and so on, you know. But most important, okay, so, I mean, obviously, you know, if you look at LeBron James and you look at Michael Jordan and Kobe and all of that, and you look at the football players, you know, our young people look at that and they say, you know what, I'm going to work hard, I'm going to play ball, I'm going to do everything that I can because I want to play in the NBA, right? So what I think, my opinion of what you've done is this is going to have young black women and men, you know,
and men
to be able to see, you know, I mean, Dr. James Coler talked about your book. He said, you know, when you focus on success in order to bring about change, right? That was basically what this project was all about. Talk about that, please.
Well,
please,
you know,
Crystal.
What? The project, you know, I don't want anybody to think like, oh, I'm some great visionary because I wasn't even doing the book.
Mm-hmm.
I was making a film because I am concerned about the images of black people in media.
Yes.
Because everything is media. And so media hypes up. And let's talk about a Michael Jordan. You know, I had the fabulous experience of being with them in Barcelona.
Mm.
So I got to travel with the Dream Team to Barcelona to the Olympics. Michael Jordan would be extraordinary whether he was black, white, yellow, green, or otherwise. And they pump him up as extraordinary black.
Mm.
Everybody is not born a Michael Jordan.
Absolutely.
What they don't pump up is how hard he works.
Yes.
His discipline. That was one hard-working man. My goal was to, with all my work, is to change the perception of how we perceive ourselves and how mainstream culture perceives us. Was I trying to do a film on black women doctors? No. I was trying to get Will Smith to buy one of my screenplays.
Okay.
In the meantime, I went with Dr. Forrester Lee at Yale to interview the first black woman that attended medical school. And Juan, I was floored by their stories. And I said, every little black girl and her family needs to hear these stories because these women did not allow racism, sexism, or economics to deter them from their dream.
Yes.
And my goal was to take these stories and share it with everyone. Out of that film, I was looking at some stills, pictures, and I had these beautiful shots of some of the women. And I said, everything is media. What would happen if a little black girl, little black boy, all over the world had these pictures that they could look at, something tangible? Because that's what we don't have in the media. So the book started with 25 doctors, and then I needed to expand it, and it ended up with 106 black doctors.
Wow, okay.
And the response to it has been phenomenal, but the response from kids has just been positively overwhelming.
Tell me, I mean, you've gone into schools and you've shared all of this with young children. Could you tell us a little bit about, one of those stories, when you saw what your book could do for young people?
We were at Career High School with a group of about 50 students. And one of the girls said, and one of my doctors, Dr. Karen Morris Friesley, came to speak. And afterwards, one of the girls said, I never told anybody that I wanted to be a doctor because I didn't want them to laugh at me.
Wow.
Because it was so unrealistic. And she hadn't taken science classes, and she said, I feel after hearing this doctor and looking at the doctors in a book, that I can do this. And that was not me prompting her, asking her a question. She came up to me afterwards.
That's very interesting because, when our kids tell us they want to play ball, we don't tell them that you can't make it. I mean, we know that it's going to be hard, right? The chances are. Matter of fact, you have a better chance of becoming a doctor than playing in the NBA.
Can learn the skills of being a good doctor.
Yes.
You have to be born with some serious physical attributes to be a ball player in the NBA.
Mm.
But one of the things at Wexler, one of our little babies, because I call all of these my babies,
yes,
said to me, she's in the book, Kalada. When I met her, I said, what do you want to be when you grow up? She was 6 years old. She said, I want to be a dentist. Now, this is before we talked about anything. We paired her later at the book signing with a dentist. So she actually sat at a table. What that experience did for her and for her family is to make that dream something tangible.
Yes.
Our parents, particularly in inner city, who are not well educated, don't dream big. And because of their life experiences, they teach their children not to dream big. If they're home health aides, they know that that's a job they can do. They teach their children to be a home health aide. They don't want their children, because their children are, they're their children's heroes. So your hero doesn't want you to know that they're reading on a seventh grade level. Well, hell, half of America is reading on a seventh grade level.
Yes.
So we're not pushing or nurturing our kids because of our own insecurities and ignorances. We're at a place in America, New Haven has more programs to help our children succeed, and we don't even take advantage of half of them. Here's a statistic. Excuse me. A state survey last year found that about 40% of African Americans who have health insurance don't have a family doctor.
Mm.
Now, there are many reasons for that, but one is a shortage of doctors who look like them, who will take their insurances. But the other part is when somebody tells us no, we automatically close the door. Juan, do you know how many people tell me no? Do you know when I tried to raise $800,000 and I roll up in there with wild-looking braids, a black lady in a wheelchair, do you know how many people tell me no?
Well, the Robert Johnson Foundation, they saw you, they heard your story, and they said yes.
Yes.
That was
Robert
great.
Robert Wood Johnson,
yes.
Ward Foundation, Kellogg Foundation, and Connecticut Health Foundation has been a big supporter of this project, as well as Universal Health Foundation.
Question for you. Now, this issue, the issue of, the social, economic and social political issues that put us in a situation in America where we don't have a lot of black female doctors, right? Can you tell me a little bit about at least maybe one story that really, I know there were over 100 stories. Just one story that really, spoke to you profoundly about one of these doctors that you
You know, Juan, I'm going to use Dr. Karen Priestley.
Yes.
Dr. Karen Morris Priestley. And I'm going to tell you why. You know, Juan, we can choose our course. We can wake up and choose the cup half empty, the cup half full, or say the cup runneth over. Even on a bad day, Juan, I say the cup runneth over because I think Les Brown said, life will knock you down, but if you can see your way up, you can get up. A lot of our community chooses not to get up. Sure, there are all these social, economic reasons, poverty, racism. You know, I heard somebody say that poverty is traumatic, right? Traumatizes you.
Mm-hmm.
One, according by American standards, I grew up poor. I didn't know I was poor until some white person doing some statistics told me. I had a great life growing up. So to use an excuse that poverty is going to hold you back. So I'm going to tell you about Karen. I just got a cough here for a minute.
That's okay. Take your time. Juan Castillo with you. I'm speaking with Crystal Emery. We're talking about her book and her documentary, Against All Odds, Celebrating Black Women in Medicine. You've got to check this out. She actually interviewed many, many black women doctors around the country to talk about, their plight and also their success in overcoming the odds to find success in the medical field. Crystal, are you ready?
Yes.
Okay, very good. So continue.
So I gotta tell you two or three stories. Karen grew up in Detroit, I think. And Karen had her first baby in high school. She always wanted to be a doctor. She had four more kids before she got married. And she worked as a CNA. And she told her husband she wanted to go to college. And he was not feeling that. Five kids.
Mm.
You want to go to college? Are you crazy? She didn't even know what an MCAT exam was. But she took a class at a community college. She didn't even have the grades or the know-how to begin on that road. But she persisted. She took classes without telling her husband. Their marriage ended. So here she has these five kids, and she's telling her kids, you got to do good in school. You got to do this. And they say, Mommy, what school did you go to? Wow. Karen entered Yale Medical School at the age of 40.
Wow.
5 children, 2 grandchildren. There was a time when her electricity got cut off when she was in medical school. And who is she going to tell that to? She's going to Yale, and they're like, oh, well, put it on your credit card. Or, oh, let's go do this. She doesn't have a credit card. She's living in two worlds. A reality where she goes home with her daughters who are in high school. She's working a full-time job and going to Yale Medical School. Okay?
Unbelievable.
She was featured on Oprah, Cheers to You. Dr. Jocelyn Elders, the highest grade that anyone in her family had accomplished was eighth grade. Eighth grade.
Mm.
She grew up as a sharecropper. She went from being a sharecropper in Arkansas to being the first black woman Surgeon General of the United States.
Yes.
Those are the stories that I want to share, that it doesn't matter where you came from. It doesn't matter what your circumstances. If you are focused, determined, and believe in a power greater than yourself. Because, Juan, this is where our babies get lost. Nobody is teaching them that there is a universal mind or God or a power that exists within them. Juan, I could not do all this by myself. I have been blessed by God's grace, Holy Spirit, understanding. When I am quiet, the work comes to me. The idea, the execution of it. When you are bombarded with noise all day long, you never get to hear that inner voice. What you hear is everybody else's voice telling you you're not good enough, you're not smart enough, you're not white enough, you know, you're a hoe. You know, you need to be in 50 Cent's video. You know, you need to be Olivia Pope. Look at what media is feeding not only our children, but everybody else. You have Olivia Pope, intelligent, gorgeous, you know, taking care of the world. And what is she doing? She's sleeping with the president, who is a married man. So we don't get a break in the media. You know, images, when we are brilliant, then on the other side we have to be a sloth. My goal was to take these stories of ordinary black folks who have done extraordinary things. And I want all of our children to experience this. And then I want the mainstream culture, because those children are constantly being fed images about us that are negative.
Juan Castillo with you. I'm speaking with our Crystal Emery. We're talking about her book, Against All Odds, Celebrating Black Women in Medicine. This book is about over 100 black doctors, female doctors, that she talks about their lives, and she focuses on their success. Her whole direction is to bring about change by focusing on those success, those successes that have done, you know, so much for our community. Crystal, you know, you've overcome some obstacles in your life, and you've gone against all odds to do all the things that you have done. And I don't know. I know that the Lord lives within you, and He's been watching over you to be able to create all of this work despite those odds. You know, we featured you here at WYBC as one of our honorees when we honored, black
Admiral
folks.
Admiral
Higgins' son, you know, uh-huh. And so a lot of people know about your story. I got to ask this question, you know, like, you are so full of life and you haven't let any of that stuff kind of, all these issues that you've had with your health, you know, get in the way. Where do you get your strength from? Talk about that. Your story is what it should be in this book also, you know what I mean? I would love for you to do something on yourself, but I know that's probably hard to do.
Oh, it is.
But talk about you, you know, a little bit, please.
You know what, Juan, even as a kid, I understood that there was a force bigger than me. You know, like I would go, you know, one of the beautiful things about living at Brookside was it was next to a nature preserve and our park and all the trees. And I would take my blanket and go down to the park and just listen to nature. And I understood the beauty in simplicity, that there really is a natural order in life. And as a kid, I was allowed to expand my inquisitiveness. We beat the hell out of our children's inquisitiveness.
Mm.
Shut up. I don't feel like talking about that. You know, don't do that. We don't teach our children to value the sacredness of nature. And those were things that were in my upbringing. But the strongest foundation was understanding goodness and God. Now, let me just tell you this, Juan. You know, I am like, I think Donnie McLaughlin and one of them have one of them, you know, sinner songs. Don't get me wrong. I've experienced, you know, everything from, you know, sex, drugs, rock and roll. But there have been places where I've had to make a decision, you know, being in that wrong place at 2 o'clock in the morning and saying, am I going to go along with what everybody else is doing, or do I draw a line and say, you know what, I'm not doing that. The foundation to be able to say, I'm not doing that, is an understanding that there are consequences to your behavior.
Yes.
And that instinctively, you know, doing that line of cocaine, you know, or sleeping with that person that you just met in a bar is wrong. And there's a voice that tells you it's wrong. But then there's the outside world that tells you, go ahead, immediate gratification. You live for this moment. And so an example from my grandmother, from my community, that there is this goodness, this God force in you, and you get to choose. But in choosing, there are consequences to those choices, and they can be positive, and they can be unpleasant. And that is what has held me. I get to choose every morning, Juan, if I'm going to wake up and be like, oh, God, my hands and legs are paralyzed. Oh, I can't breathe today. Woe is me. The world is bad. Or I can say, even if I'm tired and I don't feel well, I'm going to get up because I don't know what opportunities the next moment are going to bring.
And I don't want to interrupt you for 1 second. And she means that literally. Go ahead.
I don't know what the day... So last week, you know, trying to raise $2 million for this education tour, living where I live. I live in a terrible apartment right now. I woke up early, 4 o'clock in the morning, and my spiritual teacher always says, love and fear cannot reside in the same space. And I said, God, I'm not going to wake up fearful. Today I had 2 big doctor's appointments. I had to talk to somebody about a grant. But I decided, Juan,
yes,
that I was not going to start my day in fear. And that day unfolded so beautifully. It wasn't a perfect day, but there is no such thing as a perfect day. But I honored God or the source or universal mind, that you gave me an opportunity to wake up today. And what am I going to do with that? Am I going to be all negative and, oh, you know, that one, I got up and he didn't do the interview last week. Oh, my God, doesn't he know what I went through? Right?
Yes.
Or am I going to say, it's a snowstorm. You know, thank God nobody got hurt. You know, you can always do an interview. We get to choose one.
Yes.
And people have gotten so complacent or enjoyed being negative. Oh, Juan, you know, da-da-da-da-da-da. That's not in my world.
Mm.
You know, I didn't grow up that way.
Yes.
And I want to be, Juan, to be able to create, to be able to breathe, to be able to grow flowers. You know, I live on Pendleton Street. When I moved here about 8 years ago, I started growing flowers. And I did it for me because I didn't like living here. So I said, okay, let me do something that's going to make it mine and something that I enjoy. And my neighbors would come by and look at the flowers. And then I noticed next summer that the lady across the street planted some flowers. The next summer, somebody else did. And I saw, so one of the ladies said, you know, I bought a flower pot and somebody stole it. So I said, well, next year, don't buy a pot, plant it in the ground. You know, are we going to live in the negative that somebody stole the flower pot, or are we going to plant some more flowers?
Changing the face of the community also. It's a beautiful thing. Tell us about the film. The book is already out. Tell us about the book. Where can people get the book? Talk about the film.
You can get the book on our website.
Yes.
All one word, changingthefaceofmedicine.org. All one word, changingthefaceofmedicine.org. The film will be released through American Public Television in the fall of this year.
Wonderful.
We just signed that deal, and we're really excited about it. You know, it is, it's a good one because we can change the face of medicine, change the face of our community. You know, what is change? It's one person at a time. People make up a community. If we change how we perceive what is possible.
Full circle back to the 60s to 70s, each one teach one, right?
Mm-hmm.
Crystal Emery, I want to thank you so much for, you know, taking this time. I know it's been a long hour for you. I know that this community has been inspired. They're inspired by your stories about these wonderful black women doctors, as well as your own story. It's so appropriate, you know, for you to be on this radio station. We've been a force for the black community for years, and we continue. We're going to continue that with bringing stories like yours to the airwaves. That's what it's all about. I thank you again, and please, you have to come back in the fall when the film comes out, and maybe you can bring a couple of the doctors with you. And we could, you know, they can talk to our audience themselves. I would love that.
Well, there's several doctors from this area.
Yes.
Dr. Deborah Diet Desire is in the film and in the book.
Let's make it happen.
We can make it happen.
Absolutely.
Juan,
we can make it happen.
Let me thank you and Electric Drum because you have been our vehicle for information, for growth. And we know that it's not easy keeping radio stations going and offering this type of program. So it is my humblest thank you for all that you do.
Absolutely. This is Juan Castillo. This is the Electric Drum. We will see you next week.